This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Any idea what that is? The uninitiated might suggest a dental drill, but if you've ever gotten a tattoo, that sound is probably very familiar. Is it a good sound, bringing back memories of getting some ink that's really meaningful to you? Or does it set your teeth on edge with a reminder of the pain you endured? Maybe you even regret your tattoo. Tattoos have a wide variety of meanings for their wearers. Some are poignant, imbued with emotional significance. Others were spur of the moment for fun. Today on the show, we're going to talk about our tattoos. Well, your tattoos. I'm not a member of this tribe. And we're going to get schooled in the fascinating history of tattoo art. That's where our first guest comes in, Anna Felicity Friedman. She's a tattoo historian and the author, most recently, of The World Atlas of Tattoos. She's also starting up a new educational foundation, and she joins us today from Chicago. Anna, what a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So one of the things that you have studied is the origins of tattooing. When do tattoos first appear in historical documents?
So the earliest examples of tattooed skin that we have date to about 3100 BC on the skin of the famous Atsu the Iceman, who is this amazingly preserved mummy found in the Alps in Italy a little over a decade ago. We also have archaeological tools that may be tattooing tools. That there are examples that date back 60,000 years that may be possible tattooing tools. So 5,000 years ago approximately for actual skin samples and thousands more years earlier for possible tattoo tools.
And do they share any sense of what cultures these tattoos came from or what the purpose was? Is there any sense from looking at the record and trying to figure out what the purpose of tattoos were early on?
It's very difficult to discern why someone might have gotten a tattoo in the absence of some sort of textual evidence that would explain it. We do know from Atsu's tattoos that some of them, at least, were likely therapeutic because they're over things like arthritic joints, which is fascinating to think about. Earlier than that, we don't really have much evidence at all. People have gotten tattooed for a wide, wide variety of reasons, so we can surmise that people in the past were not necessarily so different from people today and may have gotten tattoos for the same reasons that we get them now: healing, commemoration, pure aesthetic appreciation, marking status, identity, all a variety of reasons.
When you say that it appears that on Atsu the caveman it might have been therapeutic because it was over arthritic joints, for example, what's the thinking on what that, how that might have helped, or what the theory was that it helped?
There are a variety of different theories. I personally think it probably had something to do with a talismanic purpose or a mark of healing. In many, many cultures, tattoos are used as marks of healing, and so it would make sense to put that mark of healing over the part of the body that's the problem. There are some theories that it may correlate with the acupuncture points and things like this, but for the most part, those have been fairly well debunked, although there's a core group of people who still deeply believe that this also may have to do with something like that.
We're talking about tattoos today. We're talking with Anna Felicity Friedman, a tattoo historian, and we are already getting so many really wonderful stories and photos from you, our listeners, about your own tattoos and the stories behind them, what they mean to you, and the photos are just fabulous. We actually have a gallery up on the Vermont Edition Facebook page that you can see some of them at, and you can add your own. Go to our Facebook page, post a photo, post a story about your tattoo, or call 1-800-639-2211. 1. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can share your story or you can ask a question of Anna. We got a note from Deirdre who sent in a photo of her raven wings tattoo. They span her back. It's a really beautiful back piece. And she says, 8 years ago, when I became a widow unexpectedly, I chose to honor my journey in grief with a tattoo. In the 40 hours it took to apply my back piece, my tattoo artist, Bill of Yankee Tattoo, and I fell in love. We have been happily together, supporting each other's artistic growth and endeavors for 7 years. Kim posted a photo of her tattoo of flowers and herbs wrapping around her ankle, and she says, my most recent piece is a tribute piece to my 3 daughters, Violet, Sage, and Olive. However, little did I know that I was actually carrying our 4th daughter at the time, and my artist unknowingly created my piece with 4 violet flowers, 4 olives, and 4 sprigs of sage, as if having a 4th was all part of the plan. My youngest's name had to follow in the theme. She became Rose, and I'm saving up now for the addition of 4 roses. And Deb posted a photo of her tattoo of the state of Vermont. She says, I love Vermont, and I prove it with this tattoo of the fall foliage and green mountains over my heart. So please share your tattoo with us. We are loving the photos. Go to our Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Anna Friedman, you mentioned that the evidence of tattoo tools go way back, and I'd love for you to describe them and how some of the earliest tattoos were actually made on the body.
Well, it's unclear. Tattooing is a fairly intuitive process. This is not complicated technology. All you really need is a pointed implement and some black carbon pigment, and you just need to get it at the right layer of the skin where it will neither migrate out nor get absorbed into the body, so in the dermis, so it's lodged firmly in the dermis. And there are many theories about how people probably learned about tattooing. You fall on a pointed stick that was used to roast the meat over the fire, and you get carbon lodged under your skin, and you realize that this mark doesn't go away. And you say, oh, I remember how that happened. And then intuitively, you can then turn that into an actual technical process of tattooing. So most of the implements are basically sharp pointed objects. So with the archaeological record, one of my colleagues, Aaron Dieter Wolf, has done some interesting research with this material. Many of the archaeological tools may have been miscategorized as simply things like drawing instruments, because archaeologists at the time didn't even think about tattooing as a possibility for these tools. So there's a lot of research that needs to happen sort of going back, looking at these pointed objects that have been categorized as things like drawing instruments, and then trying to determine if they might have actually been used for tattooing. Depending on what was around them, there are expensive types of analyses we can do. I'm hoping that my new Center for Tattoo History and Culture will be able to fund some of the research to try to better assess some of these archaeological objects to bring that history of tattooing definitively much earlier than Asti.
So when you and your colleagues have looked through archaeological records, and I'm imagining maybe said to another archaeologist, hey, I think this could actually have been a tool for tattooing. What kind of reactions have you gotten?
I personally am not an archaeologist, so most of this knowledge is secondhand from my colleagues who do work specifically in that field. But one thing that's happened recently with the popularity of tattooing in the 21st century is that people who may have had a more conservative idea of the possibilities of historical artifacts now have a much more open mind towards things like tattooing as a possible label for these artifacts. So it's exciting that we're now in a popularity upswing with the history of tattooing once again, where these materials can be reevaluated. Or when new materials come about, tattooing is automatically considered as one of the possibilities where it might not have been before.
So you say we're now in an upswing in popularity in modern culture and tattooing. And actually, you say that it's cyclical. So there is popularity and then it declines in popularity. What makes you think we're in an upswing right now?
Well, if there's anything I've learned from studying the history of tattooing for so many years, is that the popularity of it, particularly in Western culture, ebbs and flows as fashions change, as people's preferences change for different levels of adornment or showiness. And we don't have a lot of data to really be able to specifically say that tattooing is more popular than it's ever been before. But one thing that's clear from the historical evidence is that people are getting bigger tattoos than they ever have before. More people are getting bigger tattoos than they ever have been before. Whether the percentage of the population has changed significantly, it's certainly changed significantly since the mid-20th century when we were sort of at the absolute nadir of the dark age, I call it, of tattooing.
And when you say that people are getting bigger tattoos now, is that because the tools have improved or the pain has become lessened because the technology is better, or is there a cultural reason that you see?
I think it's a little bit of both. There have been some changes in technology. Obviously, the development of the tattoo machine at the end of the 19th century speeds things up immensely, and tattoo machines continued to get developed into easier, faster machines compared to a hand poking process, which takes an incredibly long amount of time.
And which you've done, right? You have a tattoo that you did with the hand poking process.
I do have a tattoo that I hand poked myself when I was in college, when I was 18 or 19. I do. So I know firsthand how long that painstaking hand-poked process takes. But machines clearly have enabled much bigger tattoos to be realized. And things like pre-mixed inks speed it along. All these sort of little developments that have happened sort of help to speed things along. New types of needle arrangements that allow for bigger surfaces to be filled in with color, things like this. Another interesting technological advance really that came from the medical industry is now a number of tattooers are using topical lidocaine to help dull the pain of tattooing. And I've had a few tattoos with this done in the past few years, and it really lets you sit for a lot longer. So instead of having to go back to the artist, say, for 2 or 3 hours, you know, every couple of weeks for 6 months, then maybe you can go for 6 hours at a time over the course of 2 months and just knock out a piece much faster. So that enables you to commit to a bigger piece because you can sit for longer during tattoo sessions.
And there's no culture.
Excuse me?
And there's no culture that says, come on, lidocaine is for weaklings. You should go and sit through the pain.
There are certainly a lot of people in the tattoo community that believe that. But for someone like me, a very sizable portion of my body is heavily tattooed. I feel like it's my dude. So, I do think everybody should get one tattoo without anything once just to really understand the process. For sure. You do need to pay your dues, I think. And on the cultural side, an aesthetic appreciation for large tattoos came about in the late 1990s, especially with the explosion of tattoo magazines that were really showing a wider swath of people the possibilities of this art form. And that became very compelling. People, I think before the rise of widespread tattoo magazines, and then, of course, the move to widespread dissemination of images on the internet, people didn't necessarily know the possibilities of tattooing. And so now that people are well aware that you can get these amazing large-scale pieces, it's something that's become appealing.
Well, let's hear from a few more of our listeners who have pieces that they're very proud of. Gene actually posted a photo of a skull tattoo erupting in flowers, and he says, this was done by a biker who lived next door in West Palm Beach when I was a 22-year-old deadhead in 1975. Touched up in 1995 in Schenectady, New York, the day of the last Grateful Dead show in Albany. Andrea posted a photo of a tattoo on her wrist with intertwining lines, and she says, I got this in February of 2015 in honor of my grandmother, who passed away during the holiday season of 2014. It's in honor of her and her life, religious upbringing, and keeping her close. The A and the M are a symbol in the Catholic Church for Mary. Beth posted a photo of her tattoo of a cluster of flowers on her forearm, and she says, this tattoo is my version of Mom. The design came from the fabric in a beautiful silk suit that my mother made about 45 years ago. She gave me the suit a few years ago, and I looked at the fabric and immediately thought it would make a great tattoo. So I traced it, and I got the ink at Laconia Bike Week shortly thereafter. And let's go to Ken, calling in from Ticonderoga. Hi, Ted. Go ahead, Ken. Ken, you there? Sorry, I bungled your name, but it is you we're looking for. Go ahead, Ken. All right, no luck getting Ken. We'll go back to Anna. You have seen so many tattoos over the years, and you have studied so many tattoos. Is what you're hearing from our listeners sound like it's within the realm of what's popular these days and some of the reasons why people are getting tattoos?
Absolutely. I'm actually following along and looking at the images on my computer here while we're chatting. And some of these are really lovely tattoos. So thanks to your listeners for sending them in and posting them up for everybody to enjoy. There is such a wide range of reasons to get tattooed, and I'm not sure that they really have changed all that much over time. And yes, all of these reasons that your listeners are listing, commemoration, memorialization of personal memories, travel memories, memories of people, homages to sort of nostalgic elements of their life, things that assert their identity in particular ways. These are some of the predominant reasons that people have gotten tattoos for centuries.
Let's see if we can get another caller on. Luke is on the line with us from Richmond. Hey, Luke, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just have an interesting, funny comparison. I'm 60, and I got a very small cursive tattoo on my arm when I was 18, when I joined the service. It was my high school sweetheart's initials. Of course, I never saw her again. But a while ago, I was working in a restaurant, and there was a very young girl, like a teenage girl, working in the dining room, and she was covered with tattoos and piercings and everything. And she saw my tattoo one day, and she said, what is that? And I said, well, it was my high school sweetheart's initials. And she said, oh, that's really gross. I can't believe you did that. But she was literally tastefully covered with tattoos. I just think it's a funny comparison. When I got a tattoo, it was like the tough, cool, romantic sort of weird thing, like getting Mom on your arm done. And now it's just so completely diverse, like tribal and choice and art and all these things. I just thought it was an interesting comparison.
Luke, for you, go ahead, Anna.
I have to say your story is so sweet and so wonderful. And I love these types of I'm not to say ancient tattoos, but you know, personal ancient history tattoos. You know, maybe she's listening in. Maybe you can get reacquainted because of this lovely little story about this memory of this person that's still on your body, right?
Yeah,
oh,
Luke,
absolutely.
Are you reaching out?
It's fine. It's fine. No, it's good. It's still there.
Luke, how come if it's something that doesn't hold the same meaning for you now, do you keep it because it reminds you of your past, or have you ever thought about getting rid of it?
Well, I've thought about taking it off, but because one can't really feel a tattoo on their skin, at least I can't, you know, it's just like I don't even see it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there, and I often see I still see people looking at it, and it's like, wow, he got that on his forearm. It's like in the old days when people did tattoos with, like, paper clips and whatever other kind of strange thing they could do, but it's just funny.
Thank you for sharing your story. I appreciate that. I'll share a couple more. Jordan posted a photo of his tattoo of a mountain ridge on his forearm, and he says, "This tattoo is in memory of my father. The mountain is Dorset Peak, as seen from my childhood home, and the words humble and courage best describe my dad, who battled a chronic illness early, or nearly his entire life, without complaint." And a listener in Barnett says, "When my daughter turned 16, it was the summer I celebrated my 20th wedding anniversary. We were walking by a tattoo parlor in Burlington, and she said, 'Let's get tattoos.' I checked into the reputation of the place, and after a thumbs up from some local friends, we did. My daughter said she was kidding, sort of, but I wasn't. I got the Japanese symbol for together, and she got the symbol for go. It wasn't until we were driving home hours later that we realized we had just gotten go together. Lame, yes, but we love it. That was 16 years ago, and it still cracks us up." And Joseph posted a photo of his tattoo on his upper arm, and he says, "I read the Game of Thrones books, and I loved the tale of a sword named Oathkeeper. I've always told my children that I will always stay true to my promises. This tattoo is a testament to always being true to my kids and a mural of the greatest book series ever written." So tell us about your tattoos. Tell us the story behind them. And we'd also like to know, do you make an effort to hide your tattoos in a professional setting, or do you feel like that taboo has disappeared? Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post that photo and a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Just ahead, a local tattoo artist tells us what it's like to be the one holding the tattoo machine. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're talking today about tattoos and tattooing. We're talking with Anna Felicity Friedman. She's a tattoo historian, and her blog is called Tattoo Historian. She's also launching the Center for Tattoo History and Culture, which we'll talk about in a little while. Jim Duval is a tattoo artist who works at Yankee Tattoo in Burlington. He's just sat down with me in the studio. Nice to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about how you got interested in this art form and performing it on other people's bodies.
Well, I guess I started out going to school for art. I always wanted to be an artist, and it was a situational thing for me. I saw a lot of tattoos growing up. My father was a musician, so I met a lot of people younger that had, you know, the old style tattoos that were just fascinating to me. And I just happened to live around the corner from Yankee Tattoo when it was being started by the person that taught me, Bald Bill. And we became friends, and it just kind of happened, and I never looked back, you know.
Do you have a specialty?
We do. We're kind of a traditional street shop, so I think over the years it was learn to do traditional tribal, learn to do traditional Americana, learn to do traditional Japanese. And because we cater to so many different kinds of people, I've become pretty well-rounded, I think.
How many people come in with artwork that they have already either designed or had designed and say, "This is exactly what I want," versus people who just say, "I think I want maybe this symbol, but go for it. Tell me what you can do."
I think in the beginning years especially, people would come in and choose designs that we had on the wall, or would come in with drawings of their own. And that still happens. More often these days, people come in with their iPhone and say, "Hey, I saw this beautiful thing. Can you do this?"
And it's a picture of another tattoo or just a picture of the art?
Oftentimes it's a picture of another tattoo, and we will, you know, I personally will talk to the person and really try to find out where they're coming from and why this design. And generally speaking, we don't like to replicate other artists' work. So we try to sort of reach that goal for them personally by designing something that fits within that realm.
Anna Felicity Friedman, you mentioned that you gave yourself a hand poke tattoo early on in your early days. Do you think of yourself as a tattoo artist?
No, not at all. I do not have the drawing capacity to be a tattoo artist.
Is what you're hearing from Jim, does that reflect what you're seeing now in terms of, I mean, we've been talking about people who get tattoos, but what about the people who are tattoo artists?
There is, I am floored by the range of tattoo artists that exist today. And that is a enormous change in the history of tattooing. We have far more genres of tattooing today than we've ever had, and far more types of artists specializing in different particular styles. And like your guest, a number of really incredible technicians who work in street shops and are capable of doing most things that come in the door. And those types of tattooers serve a very important value as well. So there's a real range, a really incredible range.
Let's go to Leif, who's calling in from Montreal. Hi, Leif. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi there. I'd just like to reflect on this phenomenon, this tattoo phenomenon and piercing by extension, since the 90s. I find a lot of conventional boy and girl necks types are sporting sleeves and piercings for days. This kind of pathetic attempt to be different, to be edgy, where they're not naturally, that's not in their nature. And I find it's a rather annoying sight, seeing these types with, they probably listen to alternative music and probably don't even really like it, but they feel they have to. And what, I don't know, have you observed this kind of phenomenon of these squares that are trying to look edgy through tattoos and piercings?
Leif, I'll give that to our guest, but before we do, let me just ask you, when you see people, how are you associating them as squares who are doing this to be edgy? I mean, when you see somebody with a full sleeve, are you sort of making a split second decision about how you perceive them?
Yeah, I'm making a decision because I'm pretty good at observing people and types, and I say, no, that's not working for you. You think it is, but it's not. And I don't do it like out of wanting to be contemptuous of these people. It's just an observation, and I'm a pretty good reader of people.
Okay. Leif, let me put this first to Jim Duval. Jim, you've got two visible sleeves here, pretty much. I mean, your arms are pretty covered with tattoos. What do you think when you hear Leif's comments?
Well, I think that the reason that people get tattooed is as varied as people themselves. I mean, from the dawn of time, what person has not wanted to stand up and say, I'm an individual or I am different? We all want to feel special or above, or not above, but, you know, set aside from the masses. We are an egocentric race, I think, of some form. Whether you're getting full tattoos to fit into some sort of subculture, or you want to wear all black, or you want to be a rockabilly or a classically looking person, I don't think that that's any different than a person that wants to be tattooed, other than that it is a greater commitment.
And do you see it as your business when a client sits down to talk to them about their motivations for wanting a tattoo? Or do you say, this is a choice that this person has made and they've come to me and regardless of why they want it, I'm going to give it to them?
I find I regard myself as also a very good judge of people. And I think after a few minutes of sitting down with a person, it is very easy to tell what their motivations are. It's very seldom that I find we have a person in the studio that is doing it for the wrong reasons, I guess. It is not my place to judge you. You're an individual just as I am, and I would hope that you are of sound judgment and self-awareness enough that you have the strength to make these choices without me saying, hey, you don't deserve this, or you're not cool, or, you know, I think that that's...
Anna, how do you respond to Leif?
Well, the interesting thing in response to your caller's question is that for youth culture, tattoos are not edgy. Not at all edgy. I used to teach a history of tattooing class for a decade at the School of the Art Institute here in Chicago. And as the years crept on, I found it harder and harder to get my students to understand that in the 1960s and 1970s, when the tattoo renaissance happened, that tattoos were not visible everywhere on the streets and on people's bodies. So it's interesting to think about how we often impose our own sort of anachronistic visions of tattooing on the people we see who wear tattoos. But for members of youth culture, this is a fashion statement. And they're just emulating celebrities and sports stars and rock stars and people like this who wear expensive tattoos today. Now, the one thing I'm seeing that's very interesting is I'm starting to see in the youngest ages of youth culture, 16, 17, 20-year-old individuals, that they are not interested in getting tattoos, that the sort of artsy, rebellious, younger folks in sort of youth culture generation are staying untattooed as a way to be rebellious. So I think we're starting to sort of come off the upswing in tattoo's popularity and maybe going into the next phase of tattooing's chapter in contemporary history.
Jim, is that reflected in your shop?
I don't know if we can see that specifically. I mean, it's kind of a microcosm, one tattoo shop in a state, you know, but we do still every day have people that are just turning 18 that can't wait to get out there and
not
start
need their
parents'
own
collection.
Permission.
Yeah, you know, the reasons that people get tattooed, you know, liberation is definitely part of it. And I think for the same reason that a lot of kids run right to the bar when they turn 21 or, you know, buy a lottery ticket when they're 18, come to the tattoo shop to get a little slice of self-liberation.
We got a note from Nancy.
Absolutely.
Anna,
and
you
I,
agree?
This is one of the reasons why tattooing will consistently persist in Western culture, that there is always going to be that reason for getting a tattoo, and you will always see a significant minority, if not majority, of people getting tattoos specifically for that reason.
We got an interesting note from Nancy, who wrote to us about her matching mother and daughter tattoo, and it reflects some of what you were talking about with young people having this desire. And she says, my daughter wanted a tattoo since she was little, but her father and I always said no. Rachel gave new direction to this discussion when she decided that she and I should have mother-daughter tattoos. Are you kidding? I said, never. At 23, she entered a residential eating disorders program for the treatment of anorexia. Once I'm recovered, she vowed, you and I are finally getting those tattoos. Her 10 months in treatment were grueling. After she returned home, we chose our designs. Bear claws, a symbol of inner strength. This symbol would mark where we'd been, but better yet, remind us of our inner strength for the years ahead. What a nice story, Nancy. Thank you for that. And let's go to Pedro calling in from Bridgewater. Hi, Pedro. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. What I want to talk about is a wonderful, I've been a full-time artist for about 45 years. And I had a show at the Gallery in the Field in Brandon run by Fran Bull back in 5 years ago in 07. And at the show, I talked a lot about the difference between male sexuality and female sexuality in terms of a man are going bare-chested and a woman are having her breasts are there. And at the end of the show, I have a tattoo around my natural breast. And at the end of the show, and I'm going to get quiet in saying this because if I ever have another comment given to me about or how my art has moved people, or it will never come close to topping this. There was one woman who held back until everyone had gone to have refreshments in the gallery. And she came up to me and thanked me for showing her how to how she could make her chest beautiful again. She had had cancer and had scars. And I don't know her name. I don't remember her name. But a person's chest is a person's chest, be they man or be they woman. And it shouldn't be because a woman breastfeeds or because a woman shows her breasts should not be negative in our society.
Pedro, I take your point, and I appreciate you sharing your perspective. I also have a friend who had a double mastectomy and had her breasts reconstructed and went to a tattoo artist who she really trusted to have her nipples tattooed on, because that was what she said made her finally feel like a woman again, was to have nipples that looked natural. And the trust and faith you put in a tattoo artist to have that kind of art done on your body that means so much to you and has so much to do with how you feel about your physical self is pretty amazing. Thanks for sharing that, Pedra. Anna Felicity Friedman, we're almost done with the time we have for tattoos, and it's been so interesting, but I don't want to leave without asking you about this center that you're launching, the Center for Tattoo History and Culture, because this is a way to carry on these conversations and the knowledge that people have about tattoos. What's your goal?
So our goal is to create this hub for a variety of different constituencies. There'll be a public-facing section for the general public where people can find out general information about tattoo history and culture. There'll be a section behind the firewall where people can pay for a subscription to access much more intensive content about tattoo history and culture. And we'll also be offering a service. We'll have resident scholars that are part of the center to answer questions from students, from journalists, from authors, from members of the general public. I get 1 to 3 emails a day in my email inbox from people seeking information about tattoo history and culture, and it is impossible for me to even come close to answering them all. So apologies if you email me and I don't get back to you. So it gave me this idea to set up this online foundation where we can support people who are interested in finding out more about this fascinating form of art and cultural production.
Well, I'm so glad you said yes to us, Anna. Thank you for talking with us. Anna Felicity Friedman is a tattoo historian. You can learn about her work and follow her blog at tattoohistorian.com. Anna, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Jim Duval is a tattoo artist who works at Yankee Tattoo in Burlington. Jim, thank you so much for sharing your experience and perspective.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a closer look at how lead contamination is monitored in Vermont. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Lead poisoning can have devastating effects, especially on children, which is what makes the news coming out of Flint, Michigan about contaminated drinking water so awful. In Vermont, there are two departments that monitor lead levels. One looks at drinking water, and the other keeps track of the much more common place that lead is found in Vermont, in the paint in older homes. We're joined now by Andrea Haugen. She leads the Vermont Health Department's Healthy Homes and Lead Poisoning Prevention Program. Andrea, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Ben Montres, who works in the Drinking Water and Groundwater Protection Division of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Hello, Ben.
Hi.
Andrea, I'd like to start with you. Lead contamination typically found in Vermont is in the paint in older homes, right?
That is correct. Yep, the primary source of lead poisoning in Vermont is the chipping and peeling paints in homes built before 1978, which is the year that residential use of lead-based paint was banned in the United States. And about 70% of Vermont homes were built, actually, before 1978.
So is lead paint a big problem in Vermont?
It is, because we have that high percentage of homes that were built before 1978. But the great thing about Vermont is that we have some really strong lead testing laws, which is a requirement that providers test children at ages 1 and 2 so that we can be protective for their health.
Ben, since news of the Flint water crisis hit, have you been getting calls of concern from Vermonters about lead in their water sources?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's plenty of citizens that have been calling with concerns, and rightfully so.
How do you monitor lead contamination in water?
So we oversee public drinking water systems. Our priority is to protect the public health of Vermonters by ensuring safe drinking water. So we oversee the federal rules through delegation from the Environmental Protection Agency. And for those public systems, we have very stringent monitoring requirements for non-transient, non-community systems. So schools, daycares, office complexes, if they have their own source of water, and then community systems. So any system may take anywhere from 10 to 40 to 60 samples every 6 months, specifically sampling for lead and copper.
So can you put this in perspective? Because, you know, we just heard from Andrea Haugen that lead paint is a problem and it is monitored in Vermont. Lead in our drinking water, something that Vermonters should be concerned about or not really?
Not really, no. So first off, the lead isn't it's not coming from the source. It's not coming from the drinking water. So in Vermont, the chances of a source being contaminated with lead is very low to non-existent. The issue is through the corrosivity of the water reacting with lead in solder or in pipes. So most waters not in Vermont isn't overly corrosive, but the systems that potentially have corrosive water likely already know about it and are employing certain treatment techniques in order to address that.
And as I think you mentioned, this is really not a problem mostly in municipal water supplies. It's lead contamination is more typically found in a single-family home or a small system.
Well, the lead is monitored within single-family homes that are connected to the municipal systems. So if there's an issue, it would be within the local plumbing or the service line with that corrosive water leaching out the lead from the lines and from the fixtures within the house.
Andrea Haugen, you mentioned that young kids, ages 1 and 2, are monitored for lead contamination at their doctor's offices. If elevated lead is found in a child, what happens?
Absolutely. So when a child has a confirmed blood level at or above 10 micrograms per deciliter, our case manager then goes out and performs an assessment and educates the family. This assessment includes testing the water, dust, paint, soil, and toys. And we have found very few cases of elevated levels of lead in the water. And in those very few cases, the cause was either the pipes coming from their private well or old plumbing. So we have never had a case of where we've gone out and investigated where we found high lead in the municipal water source.
You know, I mentioned at the beginning that lead contamination and lead poisoning in a child can be very serious. It can lead to neurological problems. How is it treated in children?
Absolutely. So how it's treated as children is to identify the source and contain it. So oftentimes, like I said, it's the chipping and peeling paint in those older homes. So the first thing, if you have a lead poisoned child, the first thing is to identify those sources and cover them up. This can be as simple as putting on a coat of paint. And obviously it's important to use lead-safe work practices if you do it yourself or if you hire a contractor. When it does get to those extremely high levels, and that's at or above 45 micrograms per deciliter, that's when a child is hospitalized and we begin chelation therapy.
So, Andrea, what should people in older homes know, whether they are homeowners or landlords?
Sure. So you can absolutely live safely around lead if you follow certain guidelines. If your home was built before 1978, be sure to check for that chipping and peeling paint. And if you find those areas, be sure to cover it up. Wash your children's hands before eating and take your shoes off at the door. And if you haven't had your water tested, then you should flush your system before using it. And that means running the water until it's as cold as it can get. And use only that cold flush water for cooking, drinking, and making formula. And if you're concerned about your water, you can absolutely order a $12 lead test kit from our laboratory.
That's Andrea Haugen. She leads the Vermont Health Department's Healthy Homes and Lead Poisoning Prevention Program. And we also talked with Ben Montrose, Compliance and Support Services Section Chief for the Drinking Water and Groundwater Protection Division of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Ben and Andrea, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, today we'll share some of your comments. And joining me is Vermont Edition's executive producer, Patty Daniels. Hey, Patty.
Hi, Jane. So we recently discussed a new study that links a toxin found in blue-green algae with neurodegenerative diseases. And Rogelio wrote us a note in response to that program. He says, most cyanobacteria don't produce the toxins mentioned in this study. For example, in Lake Champlain, we have two commonly found species. Both have the ability to produce dangerous toxins. However, it really depends on whether or not the genes to produce those toxins are switched on.
We also got several questions asking why blue-green algae has been promoted as having health benefits. So it should be noted that the blue-green algae we discussed on the program was cyanobacteria. Spirulina is the form of blue-green algae that some companies promote as a superfood. Totally different.
Okay, so on Monday, we had a civics lesson to learn about the presidential primary process because so many of us were learning in real time how the Iowa caucuses are conducted. Steve in Putney wrote, it wasn't so very long ago that Vermont used the caucus method instead of a primary. And it felt exciting to build a platform and support a candidate in an open group process. It took longer than voting, but it somehow felt more participatory than voting behind a curtain or via a postage stamp. But Steve says, I miss the caucus in Vermont, but not enough to move to Iowa.
Susan Clark also wrote to set us straight on one point. She has studied and written about town meetings in Vermont. She says, your guest stated that most Vermont town meetings vote on their budget by secret ballot. He is mistaken. According to the Vermont League of Cities and Towns 2012 census, the Australian ballot is used by 125 responding municipalities. Of these, only 30% used it to decide on the municipal budget. In fact, Vermonters are accustomed to making their decisions through open, face-to-face deliberations.
Okay, well, yesterday we took a look at a program that gives financial incentives to businesses who might create jobs in the state. And some wondered whether this program is necessary and how the money is awarded to businesses. Jack in Shelburne wrote, politicians are truly terrible at properly assessing the things they ask for and the things the legislature creates. But sadly, no one ever seems to care after the program is given funding. And worse yet, the program can become a political tool and not a functional and sustainable program.
All right. We also want to take you back to Friday when Bob Kinzel hosted a look at the Democratic presidential race between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. There was an aggressive tone among some of the callers to the show, including one who stated that one of our guests, political scientist Megan Remmel, should be, quote, spanked. Several of you noticed this, including Susan in Hanover, who said, I was stunned by this remark and what came after, namely that this caller was allowed to continue to rant. He should have been interrupted immediately and told that this was an unacceptable way to talk about Professor Remmel or any other woman, for that matter.
Well, Susan, we completely agree, and we have apologized to Remmel, and we also want to apologize to you, our listeners, for not reacting more quickly in the moment. We will be diving back into the Sanders-Clinton race tomorrow and the upcoming New Hampshire primary. We're going to hear from supporters of both candidates, including Sanders' campaign manager. And one of the topics of that interview will be the issue of Bernie bros. That's a term that is often referred to sexist online comments by some Bernie Sanders supporters. It is behavior the campaign is concerned about.
So be sure to tune in for that program tomorrow at noon. And you can always write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net with your comments. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.